This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to The Country Hour this Friday. I'm Isabella Pittaway. On the program today, Australia's recreational fishers will be allowed to maintain their current catch levels of southern bluefin tuna. That's about 5% of the national quota. What do you think about that? 0467 922 891. You'll hear what that will mean for both recreational and commercial fishers this hour. Plus, last year, the Australian wine industry produced 350 kilotons of grape marc, or wine waste. According to the CSIRO, it's the most abundant food loss stream in Australian horticulture. So to fix that, researchers and nutraceutical company Swiss are working to develop an Australian grapeseed extract industry using the waste.
The whole nutraceutical space is growing probably by many billions of dollars every year and will continue to grow for the next foreseeable future. So we see it as a really good growth market that we can exploit.
More on turning wine waste into a high-value product after the weather. But first today, hydrogen-powered tractors are about to be trialled on Aussie farms following the arrival of hydrogen-powered trucks by the end of this year. You could actually be driving a hydrogen tractor right now because they've been ready to go since 2009. But the problem's been that there's nowhere to fill up. But a company called Infinite Blue Energy hopes to do something about that. General Manager Tim Hodge says they're investing $300 million on a project in Western Australia.
So the co-injection of hydrogen with diesel, quite a number of the manufacturers already have those solutions available. I don't know what degree of uptake that has had within the Australian farming community to date, but it's certainly technology that's able to be deployed now. The more efficient way to use hydrogen in tractors and trucks and buses is through the use of fuel cells. And there's, again, quite a number of manufacturers, particularly in Europe, who already have hydrogen-using fuel cell tractors available. The biggest reason that we haven't seen hydrogen fuel cell tractors in Australia is the lack of suitable amounts of hydrogen.
So where does Infinite Blue Energy come into the development?
So IBE's commenced construction of a green hydrogen plant just south of Dongara. And this green hydrogen plant, or Arrowsmith hydrogen project, is going to be using solar and wind energy to split hydrogen off water. And that'll give us green hydrogen. The initial plant is going to produce about 25 tonnes of hydrogen a day, and we would call this a sub-commercial amount. But it's big enough for people to actually, and companies and manufacturers, to actually start to trial hydrogen-powered tractors and trucks and buses in the Australian environment.
And why would a farmer or a pastoralist switch to hydrogen? How does it stack up against diesel in terms of efficiency?
The fuel cells are by far and away the most efficient way to use hydrogen. The fuel cells are more efficient than a standard diesel motor. If you look at the literature and the experience out there, basically if you inject hydrogen and diesel into a tractor, you will decrease the consumption by about 25 to 30% and decrease the carbon dioxide emissions by about 50%. So it really just gives you a lot cleaner burn of the diesel in a conventional tractor. If you go to fuel cell tractors, then you're actually picking up a better efficiency again. Don't quote me on this. I think the combustion efficiency of a diesel is somewhere around about 9 or 10%. The conversion efficiency of a fuel cell is around about 23%. So you can sort of see that relative increase in efficiency, and that translates to less fuel being used to do the same job.
Now, it seems that green hydrogen is the clear winner here when it comes to efficiency, but as you know, diesel and petrol prices are at an all-time low at the moment. Will the price of hydrogen be able to compete?
I would think that it's going to be comparable, but probably the biggest advantage of a locally generated energy source is exactly that. It's not being shipped halfway around the world and not subject to the vagaries of international markets that are controlling the price of crude oil. So the regional generation of a fuel that displaces diesel has huge implications in terms of energy security for Australia generally. The transportation of vast quantities of crude oil around the globe has a cost, and as end users, we see that cost. So anything that results in fuel being generated locally has got to be a winner.
That is Infinite Blue Energy General Manager Tim Hodge speaking there with James Liveris. It is 10 past 12 on the Country Hour. Now, if you go back to the start of the coronavirus pandemic, it saw pasta fly off supermarket shelves. But this doesn't mean grain growers have been more inclined to sow the type of wheat that's used to produce pasta, and that's durum. Director of grain marketer Melco, Steve Mellington, says durum prices are positive, but minimal hectares are planted because it can be low yielding in tough years.
So in regards to SA, the typical durum growing areas are sort of parts of the mid-north, the upper York Peninsula, and then the lower southeast are probably the key three main durum growing areas. There are others. There are sort of a couple of pockets on the Eyre Peninsula, believe it or not, but they're the key durum areas in SA.
And where are prices sitting at the moment as we're in the back end of seeding?
So prices are pretty strong from a historical perspective with durum. So typically growers would focus, rather than in terms of absolute from a pricing point of view, a typical influence is the differential or the price spread between a bread wheat and a durum. Once durum pricing is above sort of around $80 above bread wheat, people become more progressively involved or engaged with durum production. At the moment, it's a lot better than that. At the moment, it's more like in a range between sort of 120 to 140 in terms of where durum is most likely to trade relative to bread wheat. So that's certainly good news for those growers that have persevered and stuck with durum year in, year out.
And have you seen more in recent years, and particularly this year, decide to put in durum?
The last few years have been challenging from a durum production point of view, and hence it's become it's only the resilient growers that have persevered in some respects. So I'm pleased that they are going to get some rewards for that. And part of that, well, there's probably three key reasons that's led to some of that. And that is, you know, certainly the last two, and in some areas the last three seasons, just from a seasonality point of view, have been unfavourable. Durum tends to do worse from a yield point of view in very unfavourable circumstances relative to bread wheats. The other thing which has been a bit of annoyance is that the last couple of years we've had some reasonably pronounced frost events. But I guess the main one has just been that distorted market signal in the last couple of years, as we've seen the grain market become almost generic, where wheat has become wheat from a grain trading point of view. And that's primarily been driven by the dramatic East Coast feed grain short position, which South Australian growers have benefited from a generic market point of view. But it does create that distortion where we get this dilution of value from a high-value commodity to a generic value. And the same is applied in some respects to even the bread wheat market, where, you know, premium grades such as H1 have traded at low or no price differential to a base sort of ASW. So that distortion in the market led by that East Coast drought has also weighed on growers' decisions as to what they do in terms of persevering with the likes of durum. So we've probably seen some drop off, which, as I said, is a bit disappointing because we're seeing the market now turn around in the absolute opposite direction for this coming season.
We're seeing pasta fly off the shelves during the coronavirus pandemic. Does that sort of consumer behaviour play any sort of impact into people potentially deciding to get back into durum if they previously did and potentially dropped off, like you said?
Well, I think it does to the extent of how it drives a market position from a price point of view, and where it impacts on price positively, then that ultimately feeds back into growers' decisions as to what they produce.
That's Steve Mellington, the director of grain market and Melco, speaking with Grace Whiteside. We'll have the weather cross soon, but right now the AFL is about to hold a press conference about the restart of the season. For more on that, here's Spence Denny and ABC Grandstand's Aaron Bryans.
Our special coverage of the AFL press conference, which we're standing by for, so ABC Regional Radio with us now, Spence Denny and Aaron Bryans with you. The expectation is that a press conference will get underway inside the next couple of minutes at AFL headquarters in Melbourne, involving Gillon McLachlan. For those of you who've just joined us, the reason for the press conference is to get some confirmation and some details about the resumption of the AFL season. We understand at this stage the AFL season will resume on June 11th, and Aaron Bryans, if we do the calculations, when does that mean potentially we would have a grand final?
So it'll be in the back end of October. We're looking at that week of October 21st, and I think that's the Wednesday. So the Saturday for it will end up being the 24th. And that works basically that if they start June 11 and play every single week from there out with no bye rounds, that they'll get the 17 rounds and a full final structure in as usual, which actually is an argument for quite a fair season, really, compared to the usual 23 rounds that we had where some teams played each other twice and others didn't.
Yeah, the expectation is that it will be 17 rounds, having already played one, and so there'll be 16 rounds to follow.
Yeah, we're expecting the structure is, as of Monday, teams will be allowed to train nationally in groups of 10. That'll end up progressing to full contact drills on May 25th, and then the league will restart on June 11th. In terms of the fixtures, we're probably only going to get the first 4 weeks, and that may not even be today. It could be as late as next week or the Monday after that, but we'll at least get the date of the resumption of play. And in terms of those fixtures, and we'll probably find out from Gillon McLachlan today how it will be shaped, is we should get a Queensland hub with six teams in it, which will be Brisbane, Gold Coast, the two Adelaide sides and the two WA sides, and they should play each other for at least 4 to 5 rounds. The Victorian sides and the New South Wales sides will combine to get through those 5 weeks as well, and hopefully by then the states will have eased their travel restrictions and the floating fixture can be a little bit more set in stone with a fly-in, fly-out model. And then we can get back to hopefully looking towards crowds.
Yeah, well, and I guess that's the big consideration for many people, particularly those people who've paid their membership, and you know, justifiably they're concerned that their membership is being wasted at the moment because they joined to go to the football. Although in some cases, I mean, look, to be honest, in my case, I'm a member because I want to have my say.
Yes.
That's why.
A lot of members are members because they've been loyal for such a long period of time, and breaking that drought also removes you from your tier status as a member as well. But
yes, that's
I mean, the clubs are saving face at the moment and basically saying that the majority of members have stuck by them, and whether or not that's true we'll find out at the end of the year when the actual figures come out. But yeah, it's looking likely at the moment that a lot of members have stayed put despite everything that's been happening, and hopefully that means that the clubs aren't losing too much money and the league gets to stay afloat.
We're just monitoring the output from AFL House at the moment, and no indication yet that AFL CEO Gillon McLachlan has started the press conference. The instant we do get that indication, we will take you there. And I guess one of the really big features for those in South Australia and in Western Australia is if we'll get confirmation that those four teams will actually relocate to Queensland.
Yeah, and the WA is in a little bit of a better spot because they're actually allowed to train full contact as of Monday anyway, so they can stay in WA up until the season starts and then move to Queensland on that June 11 timeframe. But the SA clubs, because we're not allowed to train in larger groups until June 8th, they'll immediately need to relocate to Queensland as soon as possible. And this isn't something that they probably were planning for either. They think they were hopeful that the SA government would allow a fly-in, fly-out model, and we found out late in the week that that wasn't the case, which means they've now need to change their plans. And as a result, there'll be players that are quickly packing up their things and potentially bringing their families with them to a Queensland-based hub.
Yeah, and the other aspect, of course, is that Western Australian players are probably more acclimatised to what they're going to experience in Queensland, because WA tends to be hotter, particularly at this time of the year than South Australia. This will be quite a shock going from about 12 degrees in Adelaide today to a 25-degree environment in Queensland.
And the actual teams that are involved, this is obviously a personal opinion here, but I think for West Coast and Port Adelaide and Brisbane, this is a really good scenario for them where they're stuck in a hub with arguably three teams that weren't expected to do well this year in Fremantle, Gold Coast and Adelaide. You get to play them, get things out of the way whilst the season actually gets back to normal, and suddenly you go home and potentially have a run of home games games to balance out this hub where you play against those harder sides, and maybe this is a good year for you.
Hadn't actually considered that. But it is a good point.
Yeah, play against the weaker sides while you can now and do that when you have to relocate, and then when you get to go back home, play against those harder teams and really take advantage of it. Press the AFL to try and get as many home games, potentially with crowds as well, later in the year. And really, it could be a good scenario for you.
Yeah, although Adelaide fans would argue that Adelaide aren't necessarily a weaker team.
Not out of the hunt, no. I mean, luckily, they won't have those 16 players missing any games unless they do another COVID-related offence, because that one-game suspension was a suspended one, so the 16 players are basically allowed to play until they do something wrong again this year.
There's been a lot of discussion around the, suitability, if you like, or the appropriateness of actually continuing the season, given that we do have a virus which is still active, not so much in South Australia, well, according to testing anyway, but we're still seeing new cases in Victoria, which is, I guess, you know, why that would be part of the hub. What happens if one player or a commentator or a part of the football department contracts COVID-19?
So a lot of it's still speculation until Gillan speaks today, but my understanding is that because we have a large amount of tests available to us nationally now, the league is looking to test players a day before they do any sort of contact training and a day before games, which could involve multiple tests in a week because you have that 24-hour turnaround to get your result. And then there's also the case that, yeah, if someone at the venue, like a commentator or an official, gets it, then everyone can immediately be tested, quarantined, and if everyone comes back, we just keep going.
Yeah.
I think the AFL is very keen to make sure that they don't have to stop at any point because it throws their end date out of whack.
Well, that would be game over, you would
exactly
think. Yeah, because then the equity is gone, isn't it?
Mm. And the hardest part about this all, and this is what the public is concerned about, is how do you contain clubs in hubs when they're, you know, potentially going to the Gold Coast and in a hotel, when at some point they still need to go food shopping, they'll have families there that potentially will go out as well, and there are questions around how can you keep players confined in essentially a prison-like environment, even though it's in a fancy hotel, but how do you make sure they don't go anywhere or contract it from someone else in a state that still has active cases, whereas that was, I guess, Mark McGowan's point was, why doesn't everyone go to WA where they don't have any active cases? Mm. And the answer there from Mark McGowan is, it's way too expensive to send 16 clubs to your state.
And there aren't enough venues either.
In that as well,
You'd be playing every day of the week.
Yeah, the AFL was pretty adamant. They wanted venues that had those LED boards so they could get sponsors involved for their broadcast deal. It's all about money, really, in terms of getting the league back underway. And you can't play at Sandful and WAFL levels unless they have suitable night lights and there's areas for sponsors. And most of them don't, unfortunately.
Yeah, and the other big source of money, of course, is broadcast rights.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And they're expected to lose about a quarter of their revenue if they don't actually, well, they're not going to get the 23-round season they expected, so they're already losing a quarter of their revenue by doing this current season, and they've still got that loan they've taken out from the National Bank as well that they'll need to pay off. So the AFL is very keen to cost cut at the moment.
Mm. What I am keen for the AFL to do is to get this press conference underway.
Yes. Still no word online that it's actually started at the moment.
No. No, it's we're still just waiting on that. We've got some padding music in one side of my head at the moment, which did disappear at 15:15. I thought, oh, here we go. It's about to get underway, but it hasn't happened yet. And clearly there's a lot of interest in getting this season underway. Or, you know, the other train of thought is just to dismiss this year. Mm. But the AFL can't do that because of the amount of money involved.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's easier for junior and local leagues, I guess, because a lot of their staff members are volunteers. And essentially for the AFL, the issue for them is, one, they have those broadcast deals that have revenue involved, and the majority of clubs need to pay their staff, so, and the players as well. What do the players do for a year if suddenly they can't play? So it's not like the league has this immense amount of money just to get through a year. They need a form of revenue, whatever it is. And unfortunately, yeah, if we were in a perfect world where the AFL had a splash fund, then they could abandon the year and just give everyone that time. But as a result, if we tried to do that now, everyone would lose their jobs. And I understand that that's happening across multiple industries at the moment. So.
Okay. So, Aaron, we can take you now to the press conference with Gillan McLachlan.
Brave new world, and nice to see you all and to be here with you. Some better news than last time I did a media conference. As you can see, we're doing things a little differently today, and this is the world we are now in. Today, I want to announce that our AFL competition is returning. From Monday, all clubs will return to training. And all AFL clubs will resume full contact training a week later on May 25. Our 2020 AFL Premiership season will resume on Thursday, June 11. All players and returning football department staff are being tested for COVID-19 prior to returning to the club, and that testing is continuing today. All players are undergoing education sessions on the protocols they will need to follow, including rigorous ongoing screening and regular testing throughout both the training and return to play period. This will also apply for umpires and key AFL match day staff once the season resumes. Strict protocols will be in place to protect players, officials, staff and the wider community. I want to say today is a significant step in getting footy back for everyone. Our fans, our clubs, players, coaches, officials and staff, our broadcast and our corporate partners, and all who love the game. We know as this situation continues to evolve, we have to remain agile and flexible to be able to adapt where necessary. We need to ensure we continue to prioritise the health and welfare of everyone. Importantly, we must not place any burden on the public health system. We have developed our model as the best option for returning to play, and we've done so following extensive consultation, including with the federal, state and territory governments and chief health officers. I want to thank the Prime Minister, the various ministers, state premiers and chief ministers and all the chief health officers for their ongoing support and guidance. I want to particularly thank federally Ministers Colbeck and Hunt, and more locally I want to call out, I've been leaning and pestering and driving Brett Sutton mad, Martin Pakula and the Premier of this state, Dan Andrews, and I thank them for their support. Throughout this evolving pandemic, we've anchored every decision in line with the advice of the respective government and relevant medical authorities. Our industry understands the opportunity we have been given. We also fully understand...
That's the CEO of the AFL, Gillon McLachlan, speaking there. Let's get to the all-important weather forecast now. It's good afternoon to senior forecaster Vince Rowlands. Hi, Vince.
Hi, Isabella.
What are we in for as we head to the weekend?
Yeah, look, a couple more cold mornings ahead. We had a pretty cold morning this morning. Temperatures, yeah, quite a bit below average. Quite a bit of frost around. But, yeah, a couple more mornings with some frost around the, particularly the eastern part of the state, but maybe a bit over the pastoral districts as well. But we will see temperatures just gradually warming, both minimums and maximums, as we head through the latter part of the weekend into early next week. We do have a frontal feature that's going to move across western parts early Tuesday morning and then across reaching central parts by late Tuesday evening. So we will see some showers extending over the agricultural areas and perhaps the southern pastoral districts as well, associated with that front. So, yeah, we'll start to see the activity on Tuesday, and then that will continue during Wednesday, Thursday and Friday right across the agricultural area and southern pastorals. Most of the activity will be about the southern agricultural area, so as you know, usual locations where we do expect the higher rainfall, about the ranges, about the lower southeastern coastal fringes. So we are expecting those places again to see most of the rainfall. And during that period, Tuesday to Friday, at this stage it's still a little bit uncertain with the timing of the front, but we generally looking at maybe 5 to 10 millimetres about the southern agricultural area and a bit less further north. So, yeah, some pretty cold mornings, some nice days on the way, but then we're looking at some more wet weather moving across the southern half of the state from Tuesday onwards.
Vince, thank you very much. That's Vince Rollins at the Weather Bureau. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now. And for the Upper Western District, tomorrow's a sunny day. Overnight, it's going to be between 6 and 9 degrees and then getting up to the low 20s. And for the Lower Western District, it'll be a sunny day tomorrow. There'll be a bit of fog about in the far west early in the morning. Overnight, again, it will be cool between 3 and 7. And then it will reach around 20 degrees. Still to come on the Country Hour, people planning to travel regionally. Is that you?
You're listening to the Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Isabella Pittaway. Isabella Pittaway.
Hello, great to have your company this Friday afternoon. Coming up this half hour, as social restrictions begin to ease, we might not be able to go to the pub like our NT mates, but regional travel is back on the cards and travellers are keen to get to the outback. Do you have plans to travel regionally this weekend? 0467 922 891. I'd love to hear from you today. You can also give me a call on 1300 222 891. Station stays have been getting a lot of interest from people keen to get on the road. Also this lunchtime, cowcohol. Just when you thought you'd heard it all, an American dairy farmer is making vodka from whey.
What we really wanted to do is create the cowcohol to have some uniqueness to it. So it really is really smooth. It's got almost a kind of caramel-like finish to it.
Would you be up for trying the milk-based vodka? I'll have more on that this lunchtime. Right now, though, it's just after 12:30 with the latest in news headlines. It's good afternoon to Wendy Glamachak.
Good afternoon, Isabella. In the news this hour, the AFL will resume the season on June the 11th, with training set to start on Monday. Speaking at a press conference at Docklands Stadium, Chief Executive Gillon McLachlan said teams would be permitted to do non-contact training from next week. Full contact training will resume on May the 25th. In our state, dozens of police officers have stormed a Murray Bridge home where police say a 20-person gathering was held overnight, which spilled over into an attack on police called in after noise complaints. Several people were arrested about 11 o'clock this morning. Police alleged they were attacked with rocks and bottles when they went to the property around 2 a.m. and they were forced to abandon their car and retreat. And the Greens say young people are bearing the brunt of the economic crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic and subsequent restrictions imposed by government. Australia's youth and unemployment rate jumped from 11.5% to 13.8% last month as restrictions shut down parts of the economy. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks, Wendy. Now, let's talk fishing, because a federal government decision will allow recreational catches of southern bluefin tuna to remain at current levels, and that's up to 5% of the nation's quota. It comes after preliminary results of a scientific survey into recreational catch levels, which found most of the fish were caught off South Australia's Fluorio Peninsula and Portland in Victoria. Australian Recreational Fishing Foundation Chair Brett Cleary is welcoming the move.
It's good news, and it's taken us a long time to get to this point where we now have some security. So, yes, it's good news.
Specifically why?
Well, because I think this probably goes back 10 years, perhaps even longer, that there's always been uncertainty about the recreational catch of SBT in Australia. Many years ago, the allocation, it's an internationally managed fishery, and the allocation was purchased and given to the commercial sector in totality, so that it was all of it went to the commercial sector. And if you fast forward a few years, and the species, for a number of different reasons, went into decline, there was a spotlight put on by the international managers of all forms of mortality. So the recreational sector had to start to account for the fish that they were catching. And to do that, we needed to get an idea of how many we were catching, because this is something that we've been doing since the late 1800s, early 1900s. So recreational SBT fishing has been happening for a very long time, and all of a sudden we had to start to account for what we were catching. So because of that, the recreational sector was concerned that other forces may come to play here, and we could potentially have reduced bag limits, or heaven forbid, we could have been stopped from fishing for them altogether. So the peak bodies around Australia, Recfish South Australia, VR Fish, Tar Fish, and the national body, ARFF, have been working very hard with the department and the minister to lobby for our right to continue to fish. And today's announcement, Senator Jonathan Dunningham has made that decision that we can continue to do what we've been doing for many years, and that is enjoy fishing for SBT with no need for any changes to bag limits, possession limits or size limits. So that's a good result for recreational fishing.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but the government's going to set aside 5% of Australia's share of our catch for rec fishers?
That's correct, yes. So 5% of the total allocation that comes to Australia now will be set aside to account for other forms of mortality in the fishing. So 95% will go to the commercial sector, 5% to the recreational sector. That in itself is a number that satisfies our current needs, and it also gives us the opportunity that we're working very hard as recreational anglers to improve our fishing practices, and hence that in turn helps protect the stock. So there's a program called Tuna Champions, which we're all trying to sign on to and fish under best practices. And that helps reduce mortality. So as the stock starts to improve, the allocation that comes to Australia will start to increase, and we will get our percentage of that increase.
But how can you possibly monitor with recreational fishermen? I can understand with an industry you can monitor it. How can you possibly monitor whether you get 3, 4, 5 or indeed 6, 7, 8%?
Well, that's exactly what we've just done. So that the federal government has worked with industry and with IMAS to develop a survey methodology. That survey took place in 2019, and that has come up with a number which we're now basing these figures on. Now, your question is, how do you continue to do that? In the future, there may be a need for further monitoring, but there is a buffer in the amount. So the 5%, we're not catching that currently. So there is a buffer built in, so there is room for expansion. And the other thing, of course, is that the fishery is it fluctuates from state to state. Some states have very good runs. Other states are very quiet. So you may find into the future, for instance, in South Australia, you might have a good run of SBT and people will question, are we getting close to catching that 5%? But you'd need to have a look at all of the other states to see how they're going as well, because the fish do move around. Recreational anglers aren't like commercial fishers. Most of us only get to go fishing at weekends or very spasmatically. Weather certainly plays a factor. So there's a whole range of different things. So the amount of fish that has been set aside certainly covers our current needs, and we would be very supportive if in the future, perhaps in 5 years' time, there was a need for another survey to see where we were and to see if that split of the quota needed to be adjusted.
That's the Australian Recreational Fishing Foundation Chair Brett Cleary speaking with Tim Jeans. To the commercial side now, and Southern Bluefin Tuna Industry Association CEO Brian Jeffries says the decision brings certainty going forward.
We were always with a lack of knowledge, I might say, about what the actual recreational catch was, what it was between various states, and what this survey, which has reached a high degree of statistical confidence, has really shown exactly what the catch is nationally and therefore what the shares of the future catches may be. It's really finalised the issue.
How do you feel about the share of southern bluefin tuna between the commercial industry and the rec fishing sector?
Well, it's a very difficult issue for the commercial sector because the system is based on the commercial sector never taking any government money for any drought of the sea, you might say, for periods of low prices. So the normal government assistance that goes to properly so to a rural sector is not available the fishing. The industry is expected to trade the quota, but what we've got to do is get on with it and finalise the issue, you know, for once and for all, so people can focus on growing a better fish rather than fighting one another. You know, this is a fair result, and it's based on the actual catch with room to grow. For example, the result of the survey was that Australia-wide, the recreational sector caught 270 tonnes. Now, they immediately have gone to 5%, which is 308 tonnes. So they've got an increase on what they were catching immediately. Now, with the 5%, if the quota increases again for 2021 to 23, they'll get a further increase like we will. Now, it's only fair then if the quota happens to go down at some stage, each sector takes it on the chin.
That's the Southern Bluefin Tuna Industry Association CEO Brian Jeffrey speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. It is 21 minutes to one on the Country Hour. Up next, are you going to be travelling regionally this weekend?
This week on Landline, Australian ingenuity at its best. The regional couple making cheap COVID ventilators.
Australia was looking like it was going to be in dire straits. And we decided that we would, maybe stupidly, maybe not, that we would go ahead and invent our own machine.
And with China flexing its muscles, are Australia's beef and grain producers set to suffer? That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
My name's Isabella Pittaway. It's great to be with you this Friday lunchtime. Now, travellers are chomping at the bit to visit outback towns and stations if the demand is anything to go by. The South Australian government is now encouraging travel to regional areas, and it's not a moment too soon for the stations affected by drought and then COVID-19 restrictions. Sally Hennery from Alpana Station in the central Flinders Ranges says their property went from hosting 150 travellers in the Easter weekend of 2019 to no one in this year's April holidays.
It was pretty devastating. We have had a bit of a triple whammy, and when I say we, I mean all of the Station Stays SA group in Outback and South Australian Flinders Ranges. We've had drought for 3 to 4 years now, so our station income has been way down. We were really looking forward to, we had really good bookings for this coming, well, for this year, this season, with our tourism side of things. And then, of course, the COVID shutdown was just so sudden and so unexpected. And now things are reopening, which is fantastic, but it's meaning a really short season for us. So we obviously missed that Easter and the April school holiday burst of visitors and income from that. Just starting to get a few people coming in now, so what are we, mid-May? Yeah, so it's just cut the season off by probably about 6 weeks.
And the state government is now encouraging people to travel to regional areas. Does that give you hope and optimism that things will eventually return to normal?
Yes, we're really optimistic that the things, well, things are turning back to normal very quickly. Obviously, just our camping and caravanning side of our business at this stage, and we have been absolutely inundated with people emailing and phoning and contacting us through our website to book in from later this month onwards. In fact, I think we get some people, some campers are arriving tomorrow. So we've been really heartened by the support that we've had, and these people booking in are so excited to be able to travel again within the state. It's a mixture of both our loyal, regular customers and friends that come regularly and also people, new people to us that have obviously found us online and are booking in and just really keen to have a holiday and have a break away after everything they've gone through with the shutdown.
Oh, that's fantastic to hear. From this response that you've had from guests and potential guests, will you be able to bounce back from this?
Yes, definitely hope so. Obviously, we can't make up those 6 weeks of business that we've lost, but if the winter bookings are busier than usual, which at this stage it's looking like it will be, then that might sort of make up a bit for some of that loss and get us back on track, which would be fantastic.
Have there been any ways that you've modified or changed your business to accommodate for the social distancing restrictions and that sort of thing?
Yes, yeah, definitely. So we're just following the guidelines from the SA Health, and the caravan camping industry have worked out a really great matrix too. So changes we've made here, obviously keeping to the 10 people in a group restriction at this stage. The 4 square metre rule doesn't really apply to our campsites because we have 60,000 acres, so we don't worry about that. But we're definitely sticking to the 10 people per group thing, and we don't have sort of communal bathroom facilities that we have to be, you know, sanitising 3 times a day. It's just private facilities for the people who come here. But we've got hand sanitizer at our accommodation and at our reception as well. And we've put in a rule that we can only have one person, apart from me, come into the reception on arrival to book in because it's a small space. So they're the kinds of things that we've had to be really mindful of. And we're emailing people before they come up to ask them to bring their own hand sanitizer because we are 220 kilometres away from a supermarket here, so we can't just pop down and replenish those sort of supplies.
That's Sally Henry, owner of Alpana Station in the central Flinders Ranges. She was speaking there with Grace Whiteside. Do you have plans to travel regionally this weekend or perhaps in the weekends to come? 0467922891. I'd love to hear from you today. Someone's asking whether Kangaroo Island is open for visitors, and our understanding is that it is, that they're welcoming people to come visit. Obviously, Kangaroo Island, one of those regions that has been hit hard doubly this year with fires and then of the COVID-19 restrictions. It is a 12:45. What do you think winemakers do with grape waste? It's something that the Australian wine industry produces a lot of each year. In fact, last year it produced about 350 kilotons of grape marc, which is the leftover skins and seeds. Now, one way to get rid of it is to use it to make other types of alcoholic beverages or convert it into biofuel or animal feed. But researchers and nutraceutical company Swiss have found a higher value product to convert the waste into: grape seed extract. I spoke to Swinburne University Professor Enzo Palumbo about the work they're doing to develop an Australian grape seed extract industry using wine waste.
When we started this project, it was 4 or 5 or so years ago, we thought about the idea of biofuels and can we turn the sugars and the other material that's left in the residue into perhaps a bioethanol type product, a biofuel type product. But then our attention was turned to perhaps even some more valuable commodities in the nutraceutical space, where people are looking now at products which can add to health and well-being. And one of them which really popped up to us was driven by an industry partner, where grape seed extract is rich in a lot of these compounds known as polyphenols, or commonly referred to as antioxidants. And there had been some interesting research looking at the health benefits of this material. It has a lot of potential cardiovascular benefits. People who take grapeseed extract, that's claimed to be one of the health benefits. So our attention then turned to whether we could turn this material into a more valuable product, and grapeseed extract is the one that we eventually landed on.
And so how do you go about turning the grape marc into the grapeseed extract?
It's a number of steps. The first one is to remove the seed from the rest of the material. And working with our engineering partners, we've developed a prototype system which allows the marc to be essentially separated from the seed. The seed collected, then stored, and can be dried if necessary, and then simply extracted into water is the most common thing that is used. And that allows you then get all those goodies out of the grape seed, and eventually they'd be dried and made into powders and put into a formulation that can be added to a grape seed extract product.
And what's the demand like for grape seed extract?
It's hard to give absolute figures because I think a lot of that is commercially sensitive information, but certainly in globally there's a real big push, and we've heard about the move particularly in Asia for products which do increase the well-being of individuals. And so we're driven by that attention to the Asian market in particular. The whole nutraceutical space is growing probably by many billions of dollars every year and will continue to grow for the next foreseeable future. So we see it as a really good growth market that we can exploit.
When you take it back to, you know, the winery, for example, what is the benefit to the winery? Like, how much money, for example, could they get back from this?
I suppose it depends on the market and what the market will ask for these products. Again, it sort of fluctuates depending on demand, but it could be just another revenue source for the winery. Rather than having to treat this as a waste material, it could be processed on site and then delivered either as simply the grape seed to a company that would then extract the material, or they could do the whole process on site.
Is there a better grape variety that is suited to making the grape seed extract?
Our own research and what we've seen in literature suggests that the Pinot type grapes are the best varieties. They seem to have a lot of the really good yields of these polyphenol compounds. Having said that, we've also explored other varieties that are found in other parts of growing areas, for example, the Yarra Valley and the local regions around Melbourne seem to be a reasonably good source of this material too. But at this point, Pinot is our main one, but we're also exploring other varieties.
When will this be an actual commercial product that people will be able to go and buy?
Well, you can already buy it now. You can go to most health food shops and supermarkets and pharmacies, and you'll find grape seed extract on the shelves. Most of that material is believed to be imported. So what we're trying to do here is develop a local industry where we can make Australian homegrown grape seed extract. Our first batches, again, depending on our commercial partner, could be available in the next year or two.
Have you estimated potentially how much money you could be saving, or how much money the wine industry could be saving by taking this grape mark and turning it into the extract?
No, we haven't done those forecasts yet. I think we're just really trying to focus on the technology and making sure that it works and we can at least provide our partner the material that they require. In some cases, the wineries are charged a price, a cost to remove their waste. So anything that they can do internally without having to worry about a waste removal facility, that could save them obviously large costs. Some of the larger wineries could save somewhere between $500,000 and more a year on processing internally.
Big savings to be made. That's Swinburne University Professor Enzo Palumbo, who, along with the Swiss and a couple of engineering companies, are hoping to start an Australian-based grape seed extract industry using wine waste. So tackling a few problems there. Now, speaking of alcohol, you might have heard a few people say, this coronavirus is driving me to drink, and indeed alcohol sales have risen recently. But when you head to the bottle shop, you probably won't find what we're talking about next. Dairy-based vodka called Cowcahol is growing in popularity in the United States. Nikolai Bailhart spoke with Todd Koch, an Oregon dairy farmer who's making the milk-based vodka.
So Cowcahol is basically a spirit that we've made from fermenting our whey, which is the byproduct of our cheese-making process, and then actually distilling it into a spirit.
How did you decide to try this? Like, where did you first hear about it and think, maybe this is something we could have a go at?
So there was actually an article in the local paper about Oregon State University doing some research on taking whey and producing a spirit from whey. And actually, a neighbor guy sent me the article, and I was like, we've got whey, and I got to figure this out, because I've always thought if I could get our cows to make a spirit, that we'd be moving forward in the right direction for sure.
Does whey have many other practical uses for you, or is it kind of a byproduct?
Well, it's certainly a byproduct of the cheese-making process, but there's a lot of opportunities with whey. You know, especially if you're a larger plant, to take the whey and dry it down into a powder, and then it's used in a lot of different, you know, in a lot of different capacities.
And so tell people what it looks like. I mean, from what I've seen, it pretty much just looks like a normal bottle of vodka.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a distilled spirit, so it's a clear spirit. It takes a unique way yeast to actually break down lactose. So and the good thing about that yeast is it creates a really high quality alcohol, and so you really get a really clean, smooth spirit from this process, and it makes a really, really nice product, just neat.
Does it have any milk taste? Is there any kind of milk taste that gets through?
No, not really. I mean, when you're distilling, we're not a distillery, so we actually contracted with a local distillery to do our fermentation and distillation. But when you're working with a vodka type spirit, a lot of those products get, you can actually get them as neutral as possible just through filtration and stuff like that. But we've left Calcohol with some unique characteristics of the actual raw product. So there's a little bit of difference in how it actually tastes. It's not just a totally neutral product. What we really wanted to do is create that the Calcohol to have some uniqueness to it. So it really is really smooth. It's got almost a kind of caramel-like finish to it. So it is really kind of unique.
What's the consumer response been like?
Well, it's been fantastic. I mean, it's kind of the similar response that you had. It's like, what? You're making what from milk? That's really been it. And it's been great for us because we're a small, small dairy farm, and we decided to go vertical with the creamery. And so we're a small creamery. We have this way. We don't really produce enough to, gain interest from the process of actually drying the whey and using it that way. Hmm. So when we can take this product and, take the whey and make another product from that same gallon of milk, we think we're doing a better job. And I think that's our real goal, the whole time is to get better at what we do.
Is it a difficult process to actually get it from the whey to the finished product?
It can be a little challenging. The yields are a little low. So you're dealing with like a 2 to basically a 2 to 3% of your whey is going to be lactose. It's going to be the sugars that you can actually ferment. And if you're dealing with like a grain product or a potato product, you're going to be able to get 10 to 12% out of those.
Mm. You mentioned the idea of, I guess, or touched on the idea of product diversification. So you're not just producing milk. That must be important to you to not just be producing milk, but to try and look at diversification.
Absolutely. I mean, the dairy industry is a tough business. It's a tough business. It's been a tough business for a while, and I think it's even getting tougher as things go on. And so we're a really small dairy, and then we added the creamery. So we've only been making cheese for about 2.5 years. And through that process, we've really learned that there's really there's a population and demographic out there that really wants to know where their food comes from, how that food's made, how the animals are being treated, how the animals are living, what they're doing. And I think this product, the Calcohol really brings some really good visibility to our cows. We call them cow liberties because, they're really, truly a really incredible animal when you start looking at it. I mean, these cattle are producing incredible amounts of milk, and, it's really that raw product that gets everything started. And so it really all starts with the cow at the very beginning.
You heard it here first, Calcohol. That is Todd Koch, who is an Oregon dairy farmer from TMK Creamery. Sonia, would you try Cowcahole, vodka made from whey?
I have to say that vodka is not my chosen drink at the best of times, but I wouldn't be adverse to trying it. I'm happy to be Miss Muffet eating her curds and whey.
And you wouldn't know because it still looks like your regular vodka. It's exactly. Apparently got a bit of a caramel taste to it. So,
hey, I'd be happy to try something that came from milk. I mean, if it comes from potatoes, that doesn't sound that appealing in the first instance, does it? So why not, I say. I'm willing to have a go. I'd be the adventurer. Now, coming up on the program today, we know that we've just had announcements from the Prime Minister. We will bring you some of what he had to say in relation to the release of a new mental health plan in this current environment. And we'll also speak with our chief psychiatrist here in South Australia about how that might be implemented in South Australia. We know that one of the big concerns is those who are suffering from mental health conditions in the wake of COVID-19. And lots of people planning to head off. I know you've been asking this question. We'll check out where the busy spots are.
Excellent. Thanks, Sonia. And if you are heading back out on the road, travel safe. It should be a nice weekend shaping up. It's been great having your company this week. We're going to head off to the news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.